Good afternoon. My name is Anne Blackburn. I'm director of Cornell's South Asia program. It's a very great pleasure to welcome you to the Kayan Center today for the South Asia program's annual Tagore Lecture in Modern Indian Literature. This year's Tagore Lecture finds us in a particularly festive spirit, and really we are feeling very upbeat in the program these days as we celebrate the South Asia program's 60th anniversary with events on campus today and tomorrow. 60th, we're not showing our grade too badly yet. Okay. I won't take up your valuable time this afternoon discussing the history of the program, but invite you to look at a great article prepared by our colleague, Professor Bonnie McDougall, a Cornell professor from the School of Architecture, who has written a history of the South Asia program that is in the recent edition of the South Asia Program newsletter. You'll find that both in print form in the foyer and also via our homepage at the South Asia Program. I hope to see many of you tomorrow also in the evening when our celebrations continue. We have an exciting Carnatic violin duo, the Mysore Brothers, playing at Barnes Hall at 8 p.m. tomorrow. I would like to express now my thanks to Bill Phelan and Durga Bor in the South Asia program, who have worked hard to arrange this event, as well as our student assistants, Tan Nguyen and Laya Hess-Skinner, who really keep things going for us in the program. We appreciate, as always, access to the Southeast Asia program's beautiful Kayan Center. In the late 1990s, Cornell Professor Emeritus of Operations and Industrial Research, Narahari Umanath Prabhu, and his wife, Mrs. Suman Prabhu, initiated a generous gift to Cornell University, establishing the Rabindranath Tagore Endowment in Modern Indian Literature. The Rabindranath Tagore Endowment was created by Professor and Mrs. Prabhu in order to honor Rabindranath Tagore, a celebrated literatus and musician, and one of the great luminaries of the late 19th and early 20th centuries. In addition, with their endowment, Professor and Mrs. Prabhu sought to, quote, project a strongly positive image of South Asian literature, unquote. While collaborating with Professor and Mrs. Prabhu on the Tagore Lecture events, it has become clear, to my truly immense delight, that they have a generous and encompassing view of the Tagore Lecture's destiny and are eager to include writers connected to India, to be sure, but also to other parts of the South Asian region. Today, it is my very great pleasure to welcome Manjushree Thapa, who joins an impressive list of Tagore lecturers, including Sunil Gangopadhyay, Kiran Nagarkar, Tamima Anam, and Amit Chaudhary. Cornell University has long been a leading center for Nepal and Himalayan studies. Our faculty and graduate students have been for more than two decades in collaboration with their counterparts in Nepal, especially via the Cornell Nepal Study Program and its intellectual and institutional connections to Tribhuvan University in Kathmandu. Professor Catherine March and Professor David Holmberg, both from Cornell's Department of Anthropology, have led those collaborations from the Cornell side, and we are greatly indebted to them, as well as to Mr. Shambhu Oja, senior lecturer in Nepali at Cornell, who has staunchly supported the training of Cornell students interested in Nepal. Dr. Bronwyn Bledsoe, South Asia curator for Cornell's library and herself an historian of Nepal, steadfastly protects and expands our Nepal collections and archive. I am very happy to see several of our colleagues and students from Tribhuvan University in the audience this special day. Before saying more about Ms. Thapa and her work, please allow me to read a message from Cornell University's President Davis Gorton. Professor Gorton writes, "Dear colleagues, it is with great pleasure that I join Professor Anne Blackburn, Director of Cornell's South Asia Program, in welcoming all of you and in thanking Manjushree Thapa, noted Nepali novelist, journalist, and short story writer, for serving as the 2014 Tagore Modern Literature Lecturer. I especially express my profound gratitude and that of the Cornell community to Professor Emeritus Umanath Prabhu and his wife Suman, who endowed this lecture series in honor of Rabindranath Tagore. Tagore, as many of you know, was the first non-Westerner to be awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature, and he did much to bridge East and West through his multifaceted artistic endeavors in the 19th and 20th centuries. Likewise, Professor and Mrs. Prabhu have done much to bring together the perspectives of East and West during their long and productive association with Cornell. They came to Ithaca in 1965 when Professor Prabhu joined the faculty of what is now the School of Operations Research and Information Engineering. An expert in queuing theory and stochastic processes, Professor Prabhu had previously served on university faculties in his native India, in Australia, and elsewhere in the US. At Cornell, he was an enormously productive researcher, an outstanding teacher of both graduate and undergraduate students, and a beloved mentor who continued to maintain close connections with the university even in retirement. As one measure of the esteem in which he has been held by his students, Professor Prabhu is one of a select group of Cornell professors who have been chosen by a top graduating senior, a Cornell Merrill Presidential Scholar, as the faculty member who contributed most to their success at Cornell. Professor and Mrs. Prabhu established this lecture series as an expression of their warm feelings for the university, where they spent so many years of their lives. And on this 60th anniversary of the South Asia program, and in Professor Prabhu's own 90th year, I am delighted that they could join us for today's lecture, and I thank them again for their generosity and commitment to international understanding and to Cornell. Best regards, David Scorton. Now, let me introduce today's speaker, whom we are delighted to have with us today. I first encountered the work of Manjushri Thapa when a Sri Lankan friend working in Kathmandu gifted me a copy of her well-known and widely translated work, Forget Kathmandu, An Elegy for Democracy, a remarkable combination of memoir and reportage, often poignant and darkly amusing, published by Viking Penguin in 2005. Forget Kathmandu portrays the period of Nepal's Maoist insurgency, placing it within a wider context of Nepal's royalist and emergent democratic politics. Throughout her career as a writer, Thapa has moved across genres and writerly voices. She has produced consulting documents related to gender and development, as well as articles and essays composed in English and Nepali for leading newspapers and journals, including Himal, London Review of Books, Hindustan Times, Kantipur, Globe and Mail, Nepali Times, and the New York Times. Manjushri Thapa's larger works of nonfiction include Forget Kathmandu, of course, but also Mustang Boat in Fragments, a travel log from the Nepal-Tibet border, published by Himal Books in 1992, and A Boy from Siklis, The Life and Times of Chandraguru, published by Penguin India in 2009, the biography of a key player in Nepal's environmentalist movement and conservation history. As her many contributions to nonfiction writing and reporting suggest, Manjushri Thapa has explored Nepal, her birthplace, widely and deeply, acquiring a sense of Nepal's small towns and rural locations, as well as the nation's capital. This micro-local sensibility is clearly reflected in her first novel, The Tutor of History, published by Penguin India in 2001, and the first major English language novel to emerge from Nepal. I recall reading The Tutor of History with fascination and a slightly eerie sense of déjà vu in relation to experiences of Sri Lanka. Thapa's first novel provides a marvelous, if sometimes disturbing, fictional evocation of parliamentary politics at the small scale in Nepal, richly conveying the ways in which individuals' ambitions, longings, memories, and fractured sense of possible futures help to constitute and embody the work of politics. The power of Thapa's fiction has been widely recognized. She has participated in noted writing residencies, such as the SP Foundation and Hedgebrook. Her list of talks and readings is impressively long. Here I draw attention to only a few, such as the South Asian Writers Colloquium, the Canadian International Council, and the Jaipur Literary Festival. Thapa has read at Jaipur twice, including this year's contribution from her 2010 novel, Seasons of Flight, published by Viking Penguin. Seasons of Flight conveys the story of a Nepali woman named Prema who reaches Los Angeles through the green card lottery. This novel is striking for many reasons, including the vividness with which Prema's arrival in California is conveyed as an encounter with new physical and environmental landscapes, Thapa's evocation of Prema's sexuality in ways neither sensationalized nor stereotyped, and the elegantly understated portrayal of a migrant and a woman in transition. Perhaps Manjushri's interest in photography, dating back to her undergraduate studies at the Rhode Island School of Design, helps to account for the visual richness with which Prema is placed in space and time in LA and in Kathmandu. Manjushri Thapa is now completing her third novel, supported by the Toronto Arts Council and the Canada Council for the Arts. Perhaps we'll hear something of it today. Following Ms. Thapa's remarks, there will be an opportunity for questions and discussion, after which Professor Prabhu will offer closing comments. Manjushri Thapa has kindly consented to videography. Today's event will be made available by CornellCast via the South Asia Program's website. The videographer will not capture the faces of those of you asking questions, so I suppose I can say ask with impunity. Please join me in welcoming Ms. Manjushri Thapa.
Thank you for that wonderful introduction. Thank you to Cornell University's South Asia program on this, the 60th year, which is absolutely wonderful. Which is absolutely wonderful to be a part of. It's a program that I respect a lot, and particularly with the Nepal Study program at Cornell. This has been a center of major learning about Nepal, both within Nepal and outside of Nepal. So it's a program that we're deeply familiar with in Nepal, and I respect a lot. I'm very honored to be here. Thank you to Anne Blackburn for inviting me, friends Catherine March and David Holmberg and Bronwyn Bledsoe and Durga Bohr and others who have made this possible. Now, I am deep in the process of writing, or as my editor would like me to say, finishing a novel that I've been working on now for 5 years. So when I got this invitation, I thought that instead of talking about my old work, I would like to use this as an opportunity to really sharpen my thinking about this present novel and to look at all of the disparate elements that have gone into this work. I don't like to mystify the process of creation, but it is something sometimes that even those of us who are creating a novel aren't really sure about how everything comes together or how we're supposed to bring everything together to really bring it to life. So I would like to particularly use this opportunity to talk about the key conceptual themes behind this novel. One of them is the porousness of Nepali subjectivity and Nepali borders. And then the second main concept that I'm working with in this novel is the concept in Buddhist philosophy of interdependent origination. So one of the things that I know for certain is that my personal experiences in Nepal early on at a formative age have stayed with me for a very long time and have really turned into the germ of this novel. I feel like I'm very fortunate to have lived through a particularly exciting period of Nepal's history. I feel very much part of a generation and a sort of a group of writers who are all dealing with this kind of subject matter. I'm really part of the 1990 generation that saw democracy come to Nepal after a long, long, long period and a lot of suppressed dissent and desire for it. So 1990 is, because that was such a formative time for me, politics became, particularly through nonfiction, really became the subject matter that I wrote about. In 1989, just before the 1990 movement, I returned to Nepal from the United States, where I'd been in college. I'd grown up in a slightly elite bubble. So I was, grew up in Kathmandu in Canada and in the United States. And I went back to Nepal and I hardly knew the country, in part because the education system that formed me as a child of the Panchayat era, the absolute rule of the kings until 1990, the education system that formed me and the national education system was very much aimed at designing a national mythology that kept us in a fog about the reality of the country. So we had, we were taught and we had to memorize a lot about the glory of the kings, And while our reality, including the poverty of Nepal and the inequality, the social inequalities of Nepal, were very jarring, and it was always a constant experience of disconnection between the myths, the national myths that we were taught and, you know, told to take up, and our reality. So, after I went there, you slowly begin to see that there are so many things about our myths that are completely wrong. One of the things we all grew up absolutely believing, and a lot of Nepalese still will say just out of habit, is it's a small country. It's not a small country. It's, the 43rd most populous country in the world. It's a mid-sized country, population-wise. Another myth is that we all speak Nepali. Now, after 30 years of making Nepali the lingua franca and promoting it through the schools, it's still the situation that only 45% of the population really considers it their mother tongue. So that's not true either. Another myth that we have is that we're a harmonious sort of medley of ethnicities. And as we've seen over the years, there's constant negotiation going on between identity relations, and often this spills over into conflict. So all of these myths, I feel like before 1990 and into 1992, we were living in this fog of sort of mythology and propaganda. Now, one of the myths that for me I had always been convinced about was that Nepal was really isolated from the rest of the world. And I took one of my early jobs was in the Annapurna Conservation Area project, and in a non-government project in the mountains. And I, was very much a child of panchayat. I felt like, as an educated person, I must help and, develop the villages, the poor villages, because that was my duty as someone who had privilege. So I went to the village, expecting very much societies that lived in isolation, and of course was completely surprised when I ran into people who would mention that they're just back from Korea, or they're on their way to Malaysia, or they would just casually mention their relatives in the UK. And the same thing happened to me in the next job I took, which was up in Lomathang on the Tibet border. It's an area where in the winters are so harsh that every year almost all of the able-bodied men and women of the area come south, and they go either into India or into the cities in Nepal to do business over the winter. And so again, you'd have a conversation with a woman who looked like she had never left the village, and maybe she rarely had left Nepal, or maybe had only been to India, but she has relatives in Queens. So it was this constant process of jarring. And now at that age, I was 21. I was, as young people often are, very, very self-conscious. And I really felt foreign in my own country. And so for me, this was absolutely wonderful to start to realize that actually Nepal has had porous borders for its entire history. So if we start with the open border with India on three sides, and all of the Himalayan trade routes on the north, where people come and go, the local people come and go. There was the inception of the Gorkha Brigade in 1816, where we had in World War I, we had 100,000 Nepali men serving with the Allies. We've got Jang Bahadur Rana and a few other elite members went out and were exposed to the Western world. But World War I really was the first time that Father Ludwig Stiller, the historian of Nepal, described as the first great learning experience for Nepal, when all these men went out. They went to India, they went to France, Egypt, Mesopotamia, Palestine, all over Africa, and they saw, the breakup of empires, they saw Bolshevism, they saw democracy, they saw revolutions of all sorts, they saw the remapping of nations. And the Indian struggle against British rule had already begun. So the Bengal had already started its boycott of British goods, and the Indian National Congress was already demanding home rule. So this was while Nepal was under absolute rule. And I don't think that you go through experiences like this, you get this kind of exposure and come back unchanged. So your entire consciousness is altered by this kind of exposure. And by the eve of World War II, when Nepal had 200,000 Gurkha men, also from the India side of the Nepali population, 200,000 Nepalese fought in World War II. By this time, Nepal was already experiencing political rebellion, and the demand for political parties started up by 1940. And of course, in 1950, we got our first bout of democracy. It didn't last long. So 1960 to 1990, the absolute rule of the kings came back in again. So for me, the realization that the village was not an isolated place or a pure place, it was really extremely hybrid and open, and that the whole world was in the village, was a very, very eye-opening moment. And that is something that I've written about in other books too. My last novel was involved the migration of a Nepali woman to Los Angeles. In this novel, I'm trying to write about the village in Nepal, so or the world in the village, the world, you know, the openness of Nepali subjectivity in the village. In part because, you know, over the years since 1990, as we've seen, Nepali, you know, Nepal has just become more and more and more open, and the rate of openness has accelerated. We've got in a country of about 26 or 27 million. We're not entirely sure. There are about 3 million Nepalis said to be living abroad, and all over the world they have a very diverse experience. In India, the Nepali immigrants there tend to compete with the Bangladeshi immigrants for the lowest wages in the region. In, you know, all over the East, in Malaysia and Korea and Japan, there are people working legally or illegally also. We've seen all over the Arab world with the Arab Spring the direct impact on Nepali laborers. And the stories from the UAE, from Qatar, you know, all of the bodies that are flown back of Nepali laborers who are working there, has made the headlines for a long time now. For women in particular, trafficking has become another form of migration, a sort of particularly harrowing form of migration. And of course, there's the continued migration of the elite out into the rest of the world. I moved to Toronto about 4 or 5 years ago and shouldn't have been surprised that it was full of Nepalese. And, you know, Nepali, you can hear Nepali being spoken on the streets. So for me, this theme has always stayed with me, and I often feel that Nepal is so porous at this point that we almost, the state almost exists in a, this isn't entirely true, but there's some truth to it, in a negative way to sort of deny certain rights to certain groups of people, or to make things difficult, or to obstruct the movement of people and labor and money. So I feel like the Nepali state is in almost a post-national situation right now, and that's the observation that I've had about Nepal that I'm bringing into this novel. Now, the second major theme that I'm working on in this novel has to do with consciousness. I believe that writing is, above everything else, an act of creating or shaping consciousness, public consciousness. And that sounds very grand, but I think we've seen again and again in Nepal that this is the case, that when consciousness changes, the country changes, the country changes. Now, again, in Nepal, because politics is in the air and it's you know, what's constantly happening, when I was in the U.S. as a student in college, I was particularly influenced by two strains of thinking or theory. One was the political or neo-Marxist theory that, as a student in the U.S. campuses in the 1980s, which was Ronald Reagan's America, that was almost the only place you would encounter Marxist theory. And the second one was the post-Freudian school of theory, including feminist and other theories. So I was deeply influenced by both. But particularly in terms of the politics and political consciousness, I was influenced by neo-Marxian theory. So, you know, again, going back to Nepal, early, late 80s or early 90s, here we are, we were a nation of subjects. We weren't a nation of citizens. And our one true master was the king. That was how it was. Of all of the theory that I read at that time, or I had read at that time, Frantz Fanon really stayed with me in Nepal, The Wretched of the Earth, in light of the fact that we were all subjects and not citizens. So I was particularly drawn to his dialogue on thoughts on the dialectics between the master and slave. So these are a response through the lens of psychology to Hegel's thoughts on the master and slave dialectics, which are that the consciousness in a situation where you have such inequality in a master and slave relationship, the consciousness of both the master and of the slave are bound together in a sort of dynamic of dependence. So both the master and the slave need each other to survive in order for themselves to live. And so Fanon examined this dynamic and it pointed out how when the slave starts to recognize that it's his labor and the products of his labor that really shapes their world and not the products of the master's labor, then a new consciousness arises in the slave and the power balance starts to tip as the slave moves towards his own freedom. Sorry for using he all the time. I don't mean that. So this new consciousness also, of course, relieves the master from his perch and sort of frees everyone into being equal. So for me, this Fanon's observation of the master and slave dialectics really rang true in Nepal and also in a deeply personal way, not just in an abstract way where I could see it from far away. Now, I've mentioned that I was from a privileged background, And we can argue about what constitutes privilege or the elite in Nepal, and people do argue about this very vociferously. It's not a country that has the kind of entrenched elite that larger countries like, say, India or Pakistan do. But still, my parents were both in government service, and I'm from a caste background that brought me close to the army and the court. So, you know, I was close to power as I was growing up. And so for me, it was very important as part of my own political awakening to see that the impoverishment and the inequality of the villages was directly linked to me, because my privileges and their disempowerment were linked through the structure of the state, and that was how we were related. So it became very important for me in my thinking and in my writing to implicate myself in what I was writing about, what I saw, and to be honest about my own placement in power. I wrote about that in Musangbhur in Fragments. And after that, I think all of my work has been a way to record and to amplify the rise of consciousness in other Nepalese, in Nepal in general. And I do believe very strongly that in 1990, that is the main change that happened, is that the Nepali people began to recognize that it was their labor that made Nepal, Nepal. It wasn't the kings who were making Nepal, Nepal, or it wasn't the elite who were making Nepal, Nepal. It was really the product of the labor of ordinary citizens at this point. And of course, after that, in a way, this change in consciousness has been completely revolutionary. There's a sort of ongoing waves of revolution in Nepal. There's the 1995 Maoist insurgency, the peace process, the end of the monarchy in 2008, which is, none of us could have predicted that. And now we still have an ongoing struggle for rule of law and for a form of democracy that's truly inclusive. I think that the master-slave dynamics still persist in Nepal in very, very stubborn ways, but the arc is very clear towards equality and freedom. So nonfiction, of course, is the easier way to address all of these political dynamics that I was living through and seeing. In terms of, you know, Forget Kathmandu, or my last essay collection, The Lives We've Lost, this is very much the material of what I was writing about. Right now, in the process of constitution writing, I believe that we're still having real trouble envisioning Nepal as a country that makes equal space for the historically excluded. So to coin a term, that, or to borrow a term that the analyst C.K. Lal termed, there's the concept of the Dama Jama, which is the Dalit Maila, which is women, Janjati, which is the indigenous community, and Madeshi, the people of the southeast. That constitutes 75% of our population, and these are the historically excluded. So we've got a very, very unequal situation. I believe that another term that C.K. Lal has coined, which is peon, the permanent establishment of Nepal, is a very clarifying concept that, you know, we've got this 15% that is has always been in power and remains in power and is very much right now struggling to stay in power. So I feel like at this moment, I have not been writing nonfiction at all, and that's been a very deliberate and slightly painful choice at times. But I feel like my role has been to amplify the voices that are calling for equality and for freedom for all through the creation of an inclusive democratic state. And in this, I feel like I'm not alone. There's a large community. One of the great blessings of being a writer in Nepal or from Nepal is that we have a very strong tradition of engaged writers. And so it is almost expected. Writers, artists are expected to be public intellectuals. And whether or not they have something to say on public matters, there's a tradition of them speaking out. And so I feel like I'm very comfortable in that milieu and in that tradition of engaged writing. Now, the problem with all of this, if you're a fiction writer, is that Marxist theory can only take you so far, I feel. If you're a fiction writer, you're not just interested in political consciousness. You've got to concern yourself with consciousness of all kinds. And so you have to be concerned with of all of human experience, the entire gamut of thought and feeling and sensation that human beings are capable of or doomed to experience in this world. We're not just political beings. And to write fiction in particular is to value each individual life in its complete, in its complexity and in its sort of messiness, its fullness. And I feel very strongly that in a society like ours, which where there are divisions of gender, of caste, of identity groups, of regional identities, this sounds very obnoxious to put it this way, but I will, which is that I feel like we often have trouble envisioning other people as being as complex and as fully human as we are, or as the people we know are. I feel like we're very much divided into hierarchies, social hierarchies and roles, and it's much easier to see each other as through caste stereotypes or through sort of somehow distancing tools like that. And I honestly feel this, that particularly, and I speak here as a woman, is that I do not feel that Nepali men often feel that women have the complexity that they have. I just think these are the kinds of barriers we were raised with, we grew up with. So fiction writing is an attempt to break all of that down and to really, and you know, depict the so-called small people, the unimportant people, in their complexity, and to engender empathy among people. So that's the project in fiction for me. And so, once again, that brings me back to the realm of the psychological, so the post-Freudian world rather than the neo-Marxian world that the politics concerns. So the cycle, in search of a sort of deeper understanding of the psychological, I was drawn in the 20 or so years that I lived in Nepal after I went back from college, I was drawn towards Buddhist philosophy, which takes consciousness as its main subject. So in particular, I was drawn to the concept of interdependent origination, which resonates with the Hegelian dialectics and Fanon's political response to it, but is fuller and larger than that, and to me is very intellectually satisfying. So the concept, it's of Pratitya Samutpad, interdependent origination. It derives from the second of Buddhism's four noble truths. You may be familiar with these. So the first truth is that is dukkha, life is suffering. The second Buddhist truth is samudaya, that there are causes and conditions that create suffering. The third is nirodh, the cessation of suffering is possible. And the fourth is marga, which is the eightfold path, which is the way to end suffering. Now the second truth, which is about the causes and conditions of suffering, states that we suffer as human beings because we don't recognize the truth of emptiness or sunyata. This is a massive summary of something that people spend their entire lives studying. When the Buddhists use the term emptiness, it doesn't imply that nothing exists and all of this is just a figment of our imagination. It means Buddhism isn't nihilistic in that way. What emptiness means is that all mental as well as physical phenomena are devoid of any separate or independent existence. And that all phenomena, whether it's mental phenomena, emotions, feelings, thoughts, or whether it's physical phenomena like the construction of a chair and its eventual demise, all phenomena arise in relationship to other phenomena. So that's the concept of interdependent origination, which means that we all exist in relationship to one another. Our consciousness is shaped by each other, and we shape the consciousness of other people. And we're all implicated in each other's lives. We shape each other. So instead of talking about this concept, I'm going to read a little bit, small segments from my novel In Progress, and to give you a sense of how I'm trying to grapple with it creatively instead of theoretically, and with both of these two themes that I've worked about, that I've talked about. So my novel is called All of Us in Our Own Lives. It's about four characters who are in very different places and who are heading in different directions in their lives, the arc of their lives. And my challenge in structuring the story was to find a way where they all intersect in such a way that they affect and shape each other's consciousness and really shape each other's lives. And it is, for me, an attempt to imagine the interdependence of all of us. No matter how far away we seem to be from each other. The section is called A Herd of Goats, and I'm going to introduce the four characters before I read small segments from their passages, from their chapters. The first character is a woman called Eva Berryman, who's in her early 30s. She's an associate at a corporate law firm on Bay Street, which is the equivalent of Wall Street in Canada. And she was originally adopted from Nepal. What a relief not to have Corey Stewart snarling at her. Taking another break, Berryman? You on holiday? Stop slacking off. What a relief not to hear him sniping at Jenna Deans and Stephen Boritz from securities, or sneering at Bobby Landau, the other associate from M&A, who had been assigned along with Ava to the Toralan file. The monster, Corey Stewart had called Toralan, and he should know about monsters. For 8 excruciating months, he had blighted Ava's life with his boorishness, which masqueraded as ambition. Toralan had been Peckham and Poole's biggest deal of the year. Everyone thought that was why Lester Priest had invited Corey Stewart onto the file. On the night of the celebration at the Harbour Club, the room had been awash in champagne. All the associates had received bonuses and a deal toy, a crystal pyramid. Ava had just wanted to start in on a new file. Now, an anxious month later, here it was, a small transaction generated from her own contacts. Mackenzie, a paper manufacturer in Minneapolis, was buying Burnett and Son in Hamilton. Gordon Burnett would retain an ongoing interest, a seat on the board and an operating role. Both parties had already signed a letter of intent and a confidentiality agreement. Spread out on Ava's desk were all the files on Burnett and Son's assets, including on the uncollected receivables that had pushed the business to near insolvency. She flipped through them absently. With Lester Priest's departure, Corey Stewart had slipped into place as the head of the corporate department. There was no avoiding him now. From here on till as far into the future as Ava could see, Corey Stewart would be her boss. Why hadn't he assigned her to another major deal? Ava sighed. At which point, on seeing that you've taken a wrong turn, do you change directions? At which point is it too late? She thought of where she had started her life, an unknown village in Nepal, a wreck, a ruin of an orphanage in Kathmandu. Now, outside her office window on the 45th floor of the Canada Tower, Lake Ontario glittered in the golden autumn light. So that's her. She's a little bit at a dead end in her work right now, and she is wondering what to do and has always wondered whether she should do something about her background and the country that she was born in. So she decides to leave this job, or she is asked to leave this job because she's very not unmotivated in it, and she joins the aid world in Nepal, for me, I decided to set this novel in the aid world because it seemed to me what better setting was there to illustrate the openness of Nepal's border than through the aid industry. So that's Ava's situation. The second major protagonist in the novel is Vishnu, who works as a chef in a restaurant in a five-star hotel in Dubai. He's one of the Nepalese who has had success in the Middle East, and there are many of those, although we don't hear about them as often as we hear about the people who really are exploited and who suffer a lot. Vishnu is in love with a woman that he met in Dubai, and his desire is to marry her. She has a son from a previous marriage and to settle down with her, but of course they live in Dubai and it's very hard to start a family there if you're of the working class. They lay cocooned in the sheets, nestled in each other's warmth and comfort. Malaya was talking and Vishnu was caressing her fine hair. He could lose himself in her forever. He could swim in the swirl of the sea in her stories. He could flow with the melody of her voice. When she stopped talking, he murmured, "Tell me more, Meri Maya." "What more do you want me to tell, Maha?" "The men who catch fish," he said. She smiled. "You always want to hear about that." She nestled in closer, laid her head on his chest, and began to talk about her father and brothers going out for the nightly excursion. Vishnu could see the reflection of the lamps dancing on the waves as the trawlers receded into the fog. He could hear the roar of the sea. He could smell its salt water in his mouth. The trawlers returned at sunrise as lorries rumbled into the village, setting the day in motion. The tuna was transported to a cannery in town, from where it was shipped all over the South China Sea. The rest of the catch ended up in the village homes. "Every day we eat fish depends on the season," Malia said. "There's plantain and rice. My mother cooks that first. When my father and brother comes home, then she cooks," and here her English fell away. "Malasugui, bilong bilong, apahap, kabayo, lapu lapu." She sometimes cooked sea bass for Vishnu, infusing his narrow apartment with the fragrance of lime leaf and coconut, recollections of her fishing village. Usually they shared the leftovers that Vishnu brought back from Five Spices. Though when there was time, he cooked for her, meals flavored with fenugreek and mustard, turmeric and fried chives, the hard rock and soil of his childhood. So that's Vishnu in his situation, and he's motivated by love. He's motivated by wanting to make a family with Malaya in a situation where his sense of home is very tenuous. The third protagonist of the novel is Indira Acharya, who is probably, I think, in all of my fiction, the most elite character that I've ever written about. She is the deputy director of an international NGO in Kathmandu called WDS Nepal, and I honestly can't remember what that acronym stands for. I'll have to look it up in the rest of my novel. Of course, because she's a woman, the gender struggle is, her desire is to be the director of the INGO and not just the deputy director. So, of all the European cities Indira had visited, London and Brussels, Helsinki and Cologne, Copenhagen, and of course Frankfurt several times, Paris was undoubtedly the prettiest. She had been here before, 18 or 19 years ago, for her first international conference, a UNIFEM summit on women in leadership, a blur of bright costumes and inspirational speeches. There had been a tour at the end. The participants had been shown around the famous boulevard, the Champs-Élysées, and from a stone bridge, Indira had taken photos of the River Seine. Where were those photos now? Lost in time. They had also been bused to the palace where the kings and queens used to live, golden glass rooms, infinite hallways, grand and symmetrical gardens. Awed, she had vowed to return, and now here she was, in Paris. A scooter veered onto the sidewalk and its driver stopped at an automated teller. A woman sashayed past, gesticulating animatedly as she spoke on her mobile. A man in a tailored suit stalked elegantly down the sidewalk. Indira shadowed him, hoping that none of the organizers of the Women's Empowerment Initiative would spot her. There were, in her experiences, two kinds of conferences in this world. The first was organized by veterans who understood that formal interactions were enhanced by informal activities, including the opportunity so valuable to those from far away for a little bit of sightseeing and gift shopping. Indira had formed lasting bonds with global change makers at conferences such as those. Years later, she still kept in touch with Abuena Kwasima from Accra, Rudo Gamble from Cape Town, W. Wery from Jakarta, Mei Wang from Shanghai, Juana Hernandez from Lima, and the formidable Kadri Pustep from Tallinn. The Women's Empowerment Initiative, however, was the other kind of conference, the kind organized by overeager amateurs, usually American, who tried to squeeze as much work as possible into a few unhappy days. This time, from the first Inspire breakfast on, Indira had been obliged to pursue an asset-based approach using the principles of appreciative inquiry to discuss her work at WDS Nepal. All day long, she was trapped at lectures, discussions, and workshops, and in the evening, she had to attend solidarity dinners with cultural shows, a one-woman play set in Mexico, an all-woman Roma folk concert. Tonight, there would be a lecture on female genital mutilation. Tomorrow morning, she'd leave. Why organize a conference in Paris at all? Why not meet at WDS International had done one year at an airport hotel in Brussels? Why not save money and teleconference for that matter? Or video chat, Skype, Shipe, all that. So that's her running away from the organizers to do a little bit of shopping. And the final character of the novel is Bishnu's younger sister, Lalita, who's 18 years old. She is what the aid world would call a beneficiary. She's the beneficiary of a chain of organizations, starting with the bilateral aid organization that Ava eventually joins, which funds the WDS Nepal, which Indira works at, which works through several other layers of NGOs at the district level to get down to the CBO, which is the community-based organization at the village, which is where Lalita comes in as a beneficiary of the aid world. So she's a rare high school passed girl in the village, which is near Butul. A watery light filtered through the banana plants, dappling the world with dancing green shadows. The lawn was emerald. By its edge grew a gardenia hedge, and not far beyond was a bridge. That expanse there on the other side of the bridge, that was India. "Can't we go?" Lalita asked, knowing well that they couldn't. "Just for a minute. Just so we can step on Indian soil and tell everyone we've been abroad." Around her, the women tittered. They were waiting lazily, contentedly for their midday meal on this, the final day of the study tour. Over five astonishing days, what hadn't they seen? They had visited a cooperative dairy, a pig farm, a carpet factory, a fish hatchery, and a tea estate. This morning, they had gone to a silk factory and seen silkworms that fed on mulberry leaves. They had met women who made good money selling baskets and broom and cardamom and vegetables and nuts and dried fruit and everything. Every day had been full of discovery. Every evening had been full of cheer. If only Chandra had been on the tour. Chandra always saw things so differently. She would have had so much to say. Lalita was hoarding her observations to share with her friend when she got home. There should have been more girls on the tour, really. She had herself been included only by the favor of her Tulubwa, after old Lupton Niburi pulled out, saying her family couldn't spare her for 5 days. Lalita's ba couldn't spare her either, but Chandra had insisted. "Hey girl, aren't I here to take care of your ba for you? Don't miss this chance. Go." As far as Lalita could tell, this study tour was the only thing her Tulubwa's bogus CBO had done for the Women's Committee. The Women's Committee was itself a bit of a sham. Half its members couldn't even read or write. No one in the village knew why the CBO had set it up. But the CBO, which Lalita had learned on the tour, meant community-based organization in English, was itself a means to fund Tulubwa's politics. But this was no time to be negative. She had to enjoy this moment while it lasted. The light, the lawn, the women. There, past the gardenia hedge, India. "Can't we go?" Lalita asked again. Rama Bhauju, slumped beside her, called out to the widow of Pushpa Patrai, "Lo, Secretary Ji, we're going to have to turn this into an international tour." The others tittered. Pushpa Patrai flashed a lopsided grin. He acted a fool, but was the secretary of the CBO and Tulubwa's most trusted political worker. If I were to take you across the border, he said, the police would arrest me. Why? Rama Bhauji demanded. Is it against the law? They'd think I was taking you to India to sell you all, Pushpa Bhattarai guffawed. Chee! Rama Bhauji made a face. What a horrid man. Lalita immediately thought about Chanda's older sister, the day Suryadi left the village. Suryadi had been under pressure to marry after failing out of school, but all the marriage offers she got were from families poorer than hers, so she decided to earn instead. A family friend in the bazaar knew a manpower agent in the capital. On the phone, the agent said he could find Suryadi a salaried job in India. I'll be the son you never had, Suryadi told her mother and father. I'll send money so little Chandra and Tara can study. They're brighter than me anyways. The lodge owner began to serve the midday meal, hot and steaming in aluminum thalis, but now Lalita didn't feel like eating. She remembered the excitement of that day. Two of Suryadi's friends also decided to go and work in India. On the day of departure, Lalita and Chandra escorted Suryadi all the way to the highway, carrying her bags. You girls don't be like me, Suryadi said as they walked. Study hard, pass out of school, take care of Amma and Bua. Help them raise little Tara. The agent was waiting in a van at the junction of the highway. He had a mustache as wiry as jute, and Lalita and Chandra kept giggling. They found that mustache so funny. After Suryadi's friends came, the van left, and Lalita and Chandra ran all the way home. When Chandra's parents phoned the agent a few days later, the line had been disconnected. Neither they nor the families of the other girls ever heard of their daughters again. So my challenge, of course, is to bring all of these lives together. And for me, again, that involves ultimately the realm of psychology and the realm of, you know, understanding and investing in the inner lives of all of these characters. That becomes, I think, for the fiction writer, the ultimate challenge. And for someone like me, who's from a politically very volatile society where there's constantly something going on and the deep, deep, deep temptation to be involved and to write about it, it's something I have to keep reminding myself, is that the ultimate goal of the fiction writer really is in the realm of psychology and not in the realm of politics. So it's been a very difficult decision that I've made over this novel and the last novel that I wrote. It was to disengage from nonfiction writing for the meanwhile. And the last thought I want to share with you is that one of the things you have to do if you really are going to invest in fiction, and that's your passion, is to write well. Because you can have all of these fine ideas, you can have all of the theory you want, you can have all of the conceptual understanding, but unless you really figure out your voice as a writer and your style as a writer, you're not going to do justice to your characters or to their stories. And all of your fine theories are good for not very much. So for me, the real challenge has been, as I continue to write, to really clarify my style, my influences, to look for my literary influences, and to really figure out craft. That becomes the biggest challenge, I think, in terms of the writers who went in front of me, who I deeply revere and look to as influences, writers such as Virginia Woolf or William Faulkner, Don DeLillo, from the Western canon, Michael Ondaatje, Ma Swetha Devi from the Bengali literary canon, Parijat and Indrawad Rai from Nepal. These are the writers that I really hold as my masters. For the last few years, particularly as the novel comes into its final drafts, most of my preoccupation ends up really being about craft, and it ends up being about characterization, because there is no vehicle for your story outside of your characters, and if they're vivid, your story is vivid, and plot, and description, scene setting, summarizing, sentence structure, diagramming your sentences, choosing proper diction, exact word choice, rhythms, and all of the poetic considerations. So this really is what I'm concerned with at a day-to-day level, and what I do every day, most days, on a full-time basis right now. So it's really wonderful for me to get the chance to think about the larger concepts in my work, which launched this project about 4 or 5 years ago. And it's a rare pleasure to be able to really think about the conceptual and theoretical aspects of my work. So thank you for that. I would also like to end with thanking Professor Prabhu and Mrs. Prabhu for making space for literature in South Asian studies. It's a wonderful thing to be a sort of slightly unmade writer in with an unmade project to be able to really clarify my thoughts for this project. So thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah. Super. Yeah. Are you happy to field your own from here? Or shall
sure.
I? Yeah. Okay. So the floor is open. Obviously, we have much to think about. I imagine that many questions are coming. Please feel free to bring your ideas forward. We mentioned the word videography, so now you're all very shy. Remember, only the back of your head is showing.
Thanks. I guess I'll begin with sort of a technical question. When you're working on a novel like this one, where you have four very, very different milieus that you're talking about, how do you begin the process of researching these characters and their lives? It sounds like you're talking about, finance and the world of NGOs. So how do you become familiar with these different worlds?
The creative writing dictum, write what you know, is thankfully coming under a lot of fire nowadays. I feel like, of course, you write about what you're very passionate about, but you really must research what you don't know in order to write about it. So for me, of course, the world of Bay Street and corporate finance was very unfamiliar. I reached out to a friend I was talking to a friend in Nepal from Canada and just mentioned this was what I was writing about, and she happened to have been in Bay Street early on in her life, and she got me in touch with her friends who are still corporate lawyers. So I was able to meet four corporate lawyers in Toronto to get a sense of what exactly that world is like. There was that. With Bishnu, it was really helpful to me to actually go to Dubai and Sharjah. Going, seeing, and I use photography as a medium of research or data collecting. So just to be able to walk through these landscapes he would be living in Sharjah and he'd be working in Dubai, and to be able to walk through these landscapes and familiarize myself with them. Lalita, that comes more from experience, Lalita, because I know I worked early on in NGOs and always at a grassroots level. So I'm more familiar with the aid industry. In fact, that's the only part of the aid industry I'm familiar with, is the grassroots, the sort of smallest level of it. In order to figure out what Indira Acharya did for work, I again tapped friends in the aid world in Nepal, including women particularly who are in the aid world, who it's a very gendered world, and so their experience was very helpful for me. So it really, once I came up with the clarity on what kind of characters I wanted, I set about researching it very much just through interviews and conversations and trips.
Thank you. I am Dambar Chemjong. I'm from Nepal. I teach anthropology at Tribhuwan University and doing PhD from Cornell here. Really delighted to hear about the themes of your upcoming novel, before it is published. Really glad. But I got an impression from your presentation here, from your talk, that you are also a sympathizer of the ethnic indigenous movements in Nepal, and maybe also the movements now being staged by the Madhesis women. And my question is really practical, and about the most recent event that the government of Nepal has recently arrested Shikhar Raut, accusing him of, you know, staging the secessionist movement. And he himself actually agreed that I am after this secessionist movement and I am ready to break the country apart. What is your response to that?
to that arrest in particular, one of the things I've been very uncomfortable about after I moved to Toronto is, you know, and I hope to tackle this in my later work, is the thought of being a diaspora Nepali. I'm in deep denial about the fact that I live in Toronto. I feel very much engaged in Nepal, and I feel like my imaginative life is very much in Nepal, and I'm appalled to be living in that situation too. So for me, I mean, I've been following it very closely. I've been following the issue of inclusion in particular very closely from around 2004 or 5 when I started to, I was working for as a consultant for the World Bank on a report on inclusion. And so since then, I've been following it very closely, including how it came up, you know, how the demand for inclusion came up in the last Constituent Assembly and really suffered a blow with the demise of the Constituent Assembly in 2012, and how now there's a very serious fight back against the demand for inclusion among, you know, by the permanent elite. So I'm very sympathetic to that. I do feel like the Nepal state is again doing what Panchayat did, which is upholding a mythology that doesn't correspond to the complexity of the country. And the complexity of the country really needs to find expression. So I am very sympathetic to that. Shikhar Raut, I mean, you know, we hardly have rule of law in Nepal. So I would say it's a rule of law issue where someone from the Madhesh is can be targeted much more easily than other people. So there's the rule of law issue. And, you know, outside of that, I feel like with the secessionist movement, if there is one, which I'm not sure there is, but if there is one, then a non-violent movement, I don't really see any justification, especially with what happened in Scotland, yesterday with the vote. I don't see any reason for state oppression of it. So that's my position on that. But I would love to, because I know that you have been involved. You know, and I feel like I'm in a community where there's a lot of knowledge about Nepal, and I'm just one of the people here. So I would love to hear what you think.
Maybe later in the...
Okay.
With the drinks, maybe.
Hi, my name's Catherine March. I'm in anthropology here. And I really, really enjoyed having you here, Manjushri. It's a great, great pleasure. I want to talk, and I'm particularly grateful for your quite so publicly disavowing the national myths, which I know I'm gonna burden you with a handout that I give on the first day of my classes, which are your first five words in Nepali, and they are small, isolated, and so on, porous. The question I have, however, is that most of the examples that you gave of that porosity and your call for fiction writing as particularly embracing the circumstances of smaller people, that you have of your four characters, one is clearly not small in the Nepal context, one is clearly not small in the global context. So I wonder if you could, I'm assuming that it is Bishnu and his younger sister who are supposed to embody the porosity, the vulnerability, the interconnectedness of smaller people. Can you tell us a little bit more about how you've constructed their smallness, if I'm understanding what they're doing for you?
What I've got in the novel is, so Bishnu and Lalita's father is very ill and passes away. So Bishnu comes back for that, for the funeral, and then finds himself in a situation where his sister is alone. Their mother has already passed earlier on. So their sister is really alone, an 18-year-old girl is alone in the village, and is in a situation where she either has to move in with extended family. So Tulubua, the owner of, or the master of the CBO, the local CBO, or needs to leave. So he really needs to square away his sister. So that becomes the conflict for him, is he's sort of torn between loyalty for his sister, wanting to help her not have to move in with her relatives and to set her up in the life that she wants, which is to live with Chandra and to start a cooperative. And, you know, she's sort of, her mind is on fire with all of these ideas that she's been exposed to. And in so doing, in trying to set up his sister, he loses his space, he loses his job in Dubai. And so then trying to find his way back to Malaya and to family with Malaya becomes his struggle. So it really, for me, is about... it's different things. With Lalita, the struggle is really to have her have a full life, as full as she could possibly have. So that is her struggle. And with Bishnu, it really is to find a sense of home and belonging, which is not in Nepal. It's with Malaya, wherever he can do that with Malaya is where he wants to do it. So they're sort of global nomads. They're kind of looking for a place in the world where they can form a family.
I guess what I also wanted to know was who Vishnu and Lalita were in terms of the other aspects of their identity, are their caste, their ethnic.
They're Chhetris. They're from a village near Butol, and this is an issue that has come up for me a lot in fiction, and particularly when I write about women in my last novels. I've blurred the caste identity of the woman, because first, it's easier as a woman to have fluid identities. So when you get married, if you marry outside of your caste, you know, you take on the name of your husband, you've suddenly changed caste or complete identity. So women have a much more fluid identity. And there's, in fact, my favorite disparaging saying about women in Nepal is, "I mai ko jat hudaina," so women have no caste. Which is a way of dismissing women, but I actually think it's a wonderful thing that women have no caste. But in this novel, I decided to sort of locate them in a caste. And so they're sort of the extended family of the village, sort of the power in the village. And they live in a sort of mixed middle hill village near Butol. Please.
Namaste, I'm Pauline Limbu, I'm from Nepal. It's very interesting that you're trying to bring out the complexities of lives through novels, and you're also influenced by Marx and Hegel, you say, and you want to bring about consciousness. And I was wondering to you, what is consciousness? Is it something logical, something that's in the mind, or is it something practical that comes out of experience? So how do you bring it about in your novel?
Well, you know, I think, yeah, I think so. For me, there's the political consciousness, which I have tended to follow in my nonfiction writing. The other form of consciousness is a much larger thing, and so it really, for me, is about creating empathy for other people, and for seeing that. People who are not like you, are actually like you. So it's generating awareness through awareness of each other through empathy, I think, is the fiction writer's project. I feel like in Nepal, what we've seen, so to answer your question specifically, what is it? Is it a practical thing, or is it, you know, just a thought? Is having the thought of equality consciousness, or is acting on it part of that? I feel like in Nepal we've seen again and again and again that actually the first thing that changes is people's mind, and maybe for a couple of generations people have an altered consciousness, and then through their relations, their social relations, their immediate relations, the world starts to alter because they start changing their own relations and, you know, everything around them. So action and behavior and all of that follows the changes of the mind. So I feel like just a pure change of mind and thinking, and even the concept of equality is already a big enough change, and everything else will follow. Of course, it doesn't follow very fast. So I think that's where we're stuck right now. And I feel this very strongly with, in relation to the construction of our new constitution, for example. I feel like there's a very strong attempt to roll back what we had already gained. So several rights that women had already gained, that, you know, recognitions that indigenous communities and other communities had already fought for and were on the cusp of getting with federalism. I feel like those are all being rolled back, but I think that consciousness is already there in the people. And I think that attempt to roll it back ultimately becomes untenuous, just as in 2005 when, you know, the last king of Nepal took power. It was completely untenuous for him to have done that, because the mass awareness of democracy and equality and, you know, the sharing of that value was so strong that it just becomes untenuous to behave in such a way. So I feel like the frustration now is that action doesn't follow fast enough from that change of consciousness. But in and of itself, I think that consciousness is what, certainly what I think writers need to focus on. That's sort of the arena of our action is writing and sort of creating. And really in fiction, I feel like that's, it really is about writing about people that you wouldn't look at otherwise. And this is something that I've noticed in my own writing, but also, you know, that I'm really not interested in the stories of people like me. I'm really interested in the middle class, and fiction has always been a middle class enterprise. I'm really interested in the emerging middle class, and that's the group that I'm really interested in. And so these are, you know, the so-called ordinary people or small people, and I really feel like the elite in Nepal in particular just does not see other people, the less powerful people, as fully, as equally human as they are. And so I feel like that's my project, is to really bring ordinary people into sort of vivid life so that that empathy is engendered and that consciousness changes.
Thank you. I'm so sorry, and totally missed your talk. But my friend told me about this, and she talked about it, and it was about Nepal. And I was like, that's amazing. I should have come earlier. Skipped my class. That'd be so good. So I'm half Indian, half Nepali. Yeah. And which was awesome, because growing up, if anybody used to ask me, like, where are you from? I'd say, from Nepal. So that didn't set well with the Punjabis I grew up with. But when I came to the States and actually started hanging out with Nepalis who were outside my family, I could sense this like clear hatred towards these.
Yeah.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
But because I was half Nepali, it was okay, and I could actually understand completely Nepali, although I cannot speak it. Yeah. The question is about this identity project. Even though I'm half Nepali, the acceptance wasn't that much. Those who they don't even see as Nepali, maybe Madhesis or other ethnic groups.
So is this after
well, and
this whole new identity project has been coming up.
Do you think it's more likely to fall apart because of the young generation being, I guess, intolerant or a bit more hatred towards them, or with competing groups coming up in this democracy? Or do you think there is actually some kind of progress going on too?
I think, again, at the level of awareness and consciousness, inclusion is, the arc is towards inclusion, is towards openness, is towards equality. I think right now we're in a moment where the elite is really fighting back, especially this moment of constitution drafting, which is maybe going to last 3 more years at the outside, or maybe 15 more years, but probably 3 more years. I feel like right now it's a very bitter fight. So that ugliness that we see and the chauvinism that we see and that is openly expressed, one has traditionally been there, of course. Nepal is a small country. It's got this open border. It's a denial of the reality of how open we are, is to, you know, have this anti-India feeling. So I think that's been just a strong strain of Nepali nationalism that's been encouraged. And certainly it's directed against Madheshis, it's directed about against anyone who's not sufficiently Nepali. I think it's just a very ugly moment right now, you know, where the both sides are, it's kind of it will possibly breakthrough moment. So I think that's why the fight is so bitter, that we could possibly come up with a constitution that is really inclusive and that has a federal structure that allows for the recognition of different identities and celebrates it. So because we're at this point, it's very ugly. But of course, you know, just habitually, because even people who don't philosophically believe or, you know, wouldn't politically believe in any of this stuff, you're acculturated to all kinds of hatred in Nepal. And I honestly feel like the caste system is one of the more hateful things we have, which really, the ability to just see past people and just see their caste and not see them for people. In their complexity. I think that we're acculturated to looking past each other and to just seeing the type or seeing the, you know, the stereotype. I don't think it's the inclusion project is going to break down. I think the awareness is growing. The demand is large. I think it's untenable for us to go backwards and to erect a Nepali nationalism that is completely false. I think that attempt will be made. I don't think it'll succeed in the long run, but it, you know, in the short run, it could succeed. I don't know. I'm not feeling very optimistic these days about the Constitution. So right now, I think it may fail.
May I say something in your defense?
Please.
It is true that you are from Nepal. It is true that you are writing about Nepal's people, because they are the people that you know best. But a writer's value to us is that whatever you write has implications beyond all of the limited context. And that's why we are here. I think that if you reflect a little bit, you'll see that it is true of all great writers. When Charles Dickens wrote about Oliver Twist, what was the lesson for me from that? So a poor boy growing up in an orphanage and so on, and it made the British government aware of these poor people, and they took some action and so on. That is what happens with good writing. Similarly, Tagore, when he wrote about ordinary people, was he writing as a Bengali writer? No, he was writing about India, Indian people. I don't think Subhashini, the deaf-mute girl, was a Bengali girl. It could happen anywhere around us, that kind of problem. And then what about Pathik Chakravarti, running away, 14-year-old boy running away from home, which happens today here. And Dene Pavane, about dowry problem, happening here too. In other forms, and so on. So, literature originates from a person of certain origin, but great literature has implications for the whole humanity. That's my modest opinion.
I think that certainly what we aspire to is to get to the universal, but through the specifics.
Yes.
So, you know, you can't get to the universal by just writing generally.
No.
It really has to be through the specific traditions, the specific place that you're in, and then you break through to the universal is certainly the goal.
So let's not concentrate on the Nepali aspects of this. We are here from in America, from all sorts of countries, with a lot of background. Excuse me for interrupting.
I think that is a splendid note on which to end this phase of the proceedings, having been reminded to take some of Manjushri Thapa's interest in the small scale and the interdependent, and to think of that in the context of wider South Asian literature and beyond the region as well. Thank you for joining us here this evening. I would like to thank, Manjushri Thapa. And invite Professor Uma, if he will come and give some final remarks.
Dear friends, this is the sixth in the lecture series of what I call the modern Indian literature. I did not intend the word Indian in the political sense. Fortunately, Anne Blackburn had the vision and the sense of direction to include Nepal, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, and so on in this series. So this has turned out to be a series of modern South Asian literature. Thank you. And I thank you, Bill Fallon, our program manager, for your patient and hard work. Manjushri Thapa's stories are about day-to-day life of ordinary people in Nepal. She writes about it with sensitivity and deep feelings. Through her characters, she expresses their hopes and dreams. Family life seems to be strong. There are problems regarding women's issues, cost of education, availability of good jobs, affordable housing. These are the challenges facing even affluent countries. We in the United States are fully aware of these challenges. My personal response to these problems is best described by the following poem by Donald Justice, quoted with certain, I'm adapting this to the present context. I've selected this poem because it has the pathos that is in Tagore's songs. Excuse me. The world is very dusty, dear Manjushri. Let us work. One day the sickness shall pass from the earth for good. The orchard will bloom. Someone will play the sitar. Our work will be seen as strong and clean and good. And all that we suffered from having existed shall be forgotten as though it had never existed. Thank you.
Thank you all for joining us today. I invite you to partake of the reception just in the room adjoining here, and we look forward to speaking with you in a more informal manner as you have a chance to eat and drink. Thanks very much.